Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have one of the authors of Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy. The book is written by Wendell Potter and Nick Penniman. I have the real pleasure to have Wendell Potter on the line today to talk. Wendell Potter is a former health insurance executive. He's the author of Deadly Spin, which came out before this current book, and is a regular contributor for the Huffington Post and healthinsurance.org. Wendell Potter, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Heath. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you. This is a subject matter that I have spent a lot of time thinking about and have recently published a book that takes on the subject matter. And right. So for that reason, I'm personally interested and was just so impressed by the breadth of coverage here. It's just a really interesting read. Now, there's a lot to talk about in the book, but let's start on something rather small and seemingly mundane. In the book, you talk about what is called call time, and you provide a model daily schedule for a member of Congress. Would you tell us just a little bit about what call time is and maybe what it says about how Congress is doing its work?
Yeah, we were able to get our hands on a communication from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, a communication that was developed to give to incoming freshmen members of Congress, Democratic members of Congress, with suggestions about how they should structure their days. And rather than having an emphasis on constituent service or your committee assignments or just doing the work that I think most voters think a member of Congress does, the majority of time on a given day that is recommended for a member of Congress is that he or she spend about 50% of that time doing nothing more than dialing for dollars. And call time is just that. It is leaving the Capitol, leaving either the Capitol itself or the House office building and going to another building a block or two away, whether you're a Democrat or Republican. Both parties have big offices nearby. And they've got cubicles set up for members to go in and just be like telemarketers, start calling potential donors. And there's an assistant who will be helpful to have index cards or something like that with the name of the person on it. And that's what the member of Congress does. And not just that, but there's also what's referred to as strategic development time or something like that, and that too is developing money for re-election. So these members of Congress are constantly running for re-election. The very moment that they are elected, it begins all over again.
Now, you also have this really interesting illustration of how influential money is over public policy. You ask the reader to consider a baby named Eve. Would you tell us a little bit about how baby Eve's life is shaped by lobbyists?
Right. And we chose this to illustrate just how inescapable our lives are from the influence of lobbying from cradle to grave. And we take the example of a baby who is born in a hospital and everything about the delivery, the rules and regulations pertaining to healthcare are influenced in one way or another by lobbyists and campaign contributions. When she leaves the hospital with her parents, she is more often than not being taken home in an automobile that is influenced by lobbying, whether it's the mileage that is allowable or the exhaust fumes that come out of the tailpipe. And she goes home to where her parents have, if they've bought a house, lobbying has affected the availability of mortgages, the mortgage rate. Everything that Eve touches or that affects her in her daily life is in one way or another influenced by big money and politics. We don't stop to think about it, but it is ever present, and we just simply can't escape what we refer to as the system that has been created by big money. And as we've certainly been hearing by at least two of the very big, most famous presidential candidates, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, talk about how the system is rigged. And they both are right. The system really is rigged against average folks.
Now, as I mentioned at the start of the podcast, you have a background in health insurance. I wonder if you can talk just a little bit about how these issues play out in that sector. Is money as significant a player in the making of health policy as it is in other policy areas?
It absolutely is, and in fact, probably more so, because two of the biggest industries, or the industries that spend the most in lobbying, are the pharmaceutical industry and the health insurance industry. The money that they spend is just enormous. They spend billions of dollars over the course of a few years to influence public policy. And in fact, it's one of the reasons why I wrote this book in particular. My first book was called Deadly Spin, and it was a look at how health insurers are able to influence public opinion and consequently public policy. And that was kind of the work that I was involved in when I was in the industry as head of corporate communications for one of the largest insurance companies. But what I observed after I left the industry and began spending a lot of time representing the interest of consumers in Washington during the healthcare reform debate, it was very clear that my former colleagues were so influential that the legislation that ultimately was passed, that we know as Obamacare, was very, very heavily influenced by the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry and medical device manufacturers, by the hospitals, by the American Medical Association, to the point that no legislation would have been passed that didn't first meet the criteria or the expectations of the lobbyists for all of those industries. It does some good. I always say that the Affordable Care Act, I think, was worth passing and does some good, but it has been exceedingly lucrative or beneficial to the special interests. They've profited under the law. In fact, the two companies that I worked for over the course of 20 years, Cigna and Humana, the share price for those two companies has increased more than 1,000%. Since the beginning of the Obama administration.
So with all of the need for members of Congress to raise money and all of the money being spent by lobbyists, we must ask this sort of basic question. Has the country become an oligarchy? Is this the argument that you guys are making in the book?
Absolutely, it is. And regrettably so. We have reached the point. It's we often talk about having reached a second gilded age, in which moneyed interests are so influential that that the system really is, as I said earlier, rigged against regular people. We've reached the point that a few billionaires or their families are able to contribute enormous sums of money to influence elections. So we're not talking about just lobbying. We're talking about elections as well, too. Money is used in so many different ways. And so much more of it than we have seen in the past. I was a reporter in Washington in the 70s, when I go back to Washington now, it's, you know, the buildings are the same, but so much has changed inside those buildings. The number of lobbyists, the amount of money that they have at their disposal to influence legislation. And it's not just legislation either. It influences the regulatory part of government also, and also not just in Washington. It's pervasive at the state and municipal levels as well, too.
Now, one might assume that your take on this is a deeply hopeless one. But in the book, it seems clear that the two of you are somewhat hopeful about the potential to address some of these issues. So, is this a problem that is simply too large and insurmountable to be addressed, or do you have some reasons to believe there are things that can be done to change the status quo?
We are hopeful, and we do believe that we as a country can return to a system of self-government, which we think we've lost in many ways, because we're not talking about something that is so difficult to turn around as climate change, for example. And we've also tackled huge problems or issues in the past throughout the course of our history, whether we're talking about slavery or suffrage or marriage equality. We, at different times in our history, have taken on and resolved in many ways some much more substantial problems. With what we're talking about in the book, this much of what we're talking about can be done simply by legislation. And we just need to have the political will of members of Congress and other policymakers to do what needs to be done in terms of restoring a democracy. And we need the will of the people. The members of Congress and other elected officials need to understand that this is something that, that Americans care about. And we do believe that they do. And we're seeing the last chapter of our book is called The Makings of an All-American Movement. And that is beginning. And we think that as more and more people become aware of just the consequences of what is going on, that there will be a groundswell of support for reform, and that will eventually reach Congress.
Now, let's talk specifics here. What are the specific kind of reforms you see as most possible and whose passage might change this? What are the policy levers that you think would be most important to change? Is it all mainly focused on Citizens United, or are there other things that you think could be done?
Other things. Citizens United, of course, is very important, and that can be done. That can be reversed or changed in the future with a change in the composition of the Supreme Court, as future courts take up legislation that could be ruled upon that would undo some of the problems of Citizens United. And, of course, there's a possibility of a constitutional amendment to address that as well, too, which would take far more time and is probably less likely. But there are other fixes for that we believe would resolve about 75% of the problem, other than the Supreme Court needing to act. Transparency is an area that we feel is very important. By that we mean we think that Americans should know who is making donations in any way in real time. As it is now, in many cases, we don't know who is contributing to a campaign or a political action committee until after an election's been held. There's no reason why we can't have instantaneous disclosure of who is contributing. We think that we should do something about the revolving door that is notorious, particularly in Washington. And now about 50% of members of Congress, when they leave office, go to K Street in Washington, the street known as the place where most of the offices of lobbyists are. And they go there and they make substantially more money than they did when they were members of Congress. We think that this should be a much longer period of time before a member of Congress and a staff member can become a lobbyist. And that would slow, if not end, the revolving door. We think that we need to have lobbying changes with pertaining to how lobbyists do their work and the ability of lobbyists to make campaign contributions. And we point to South Carolina as an example. A few years ago in South Carolina, obviously a very conservative state, they passed legislation that makes it illegal for a lobbyist to make a campaign donation to members of the legislature. We think that works, and it's been upheld by the courts. Both parties in South Carolina support that, and we think that should be the law of the land throughout the country at the state and federal level. So there are a lot of things that can be done, and in many cases already is being done. In one place or another. Another is matching campaign contributions, as in New York City. If you are a resident of New York City, you make a donation to a candidate at the municipal level, there's a public fund that can match your contribution up to six times of what you've contributed. So that enables someone who is not wealthy to make a much more considerable influence on a campaign. And reduces the influence of the wealthy.
Now, would you talk just a little bit more about the movement behind some of these different suggestions? I think people would be surprised at how varied the groups are and how bipartisan or nonpartisan the groups that are pushing for some of these reforms are. Would you talk about that dimension of the book? I believe it's the final chapter.
Yeah, we absolutely are saying that this is very much a bipartisan effort, and there's just as much concern about this on the right as there is on the left. And we're seeing groups of Tea Party members or the people who would support members of the so-called Freedom Caucus in Washington supportive of this, as well as on the right. And in the middle, too, is an organization called Represent Us that works around the country with people on all ends of the ideological spectrum, as well as people in the middle, as it did in Tallahassee, Florida, when Represent Us was involved down there working with members of the Tea Party and progressive organizations to address corruption in local government in Tallahassee. And they were able to push forward some very meaningful reforms there. Some of the most vocal proponents, in fact, of reform are conservatives. One individual is a gentleman by the name of John Putner, who lives in Alabama, but who was very influential as a consultant in unseating Eric Cantor when he was running for re-election in Virginia. And he was able to get to defeat him at the primary level. And part of the reason that campaign was so successful against Cantor was they were able to portray Cantor as someone who is so closely tied, to special interest.
Yeah, the book is so interesting. Again, the name of the book is Nation on the Take: How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. The authors are Wendell Potter and Nick Henneman. Wendell Potter, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Heath. Thank you.